French were up to something. But what exactly? The Spanish king needed to know what his rivals were doing in the far north of America. Eventually, one of his agents was received in Paris by Francis I. According to the agent's report, the French king said he'd sent a sailor called Jacques Cartier on two voyages across the Atlantic and up a great river, which, the agent said,
is 800 leagues long. And well up the river there are two waterfalls. And beyond the falls, the king of France says the Indian king told him there is a large city, where there are many mines of gold and silver in great abundance, and men who dress and wear shoes like we do, and there is abundance of clove, nutmeg and pepper.
The king of France went on and on,
greatly praising the rich novelty of the land, and telling these and other tales, and that there are men who can fly, having wings on their arms like bats.
Yes, well, sounds like what we'd now call a serious intelligence failure. Or maybe the King of France was just a bit of a tease. In reality, the French explorer Jacques Cartier had hit the frozen north, not the spicy south. In 1541, he built a settlement on the St. Lawrence River, but it had to be evacuated after the first winter, ravaged by cold, disease, and the Indians. Cartier's main legacy is his name for the whole region, Canada, which is the local Indian word for village. It wasn't until the 1600s that the French put down proper roots. The explorer Samuel de Champlain sailed three ships up the St. Lawrence and found the mournful remains of Cartier's short-lived settlement.
What seems to have been a chimney, and indications of there having been ditches surrounding their dwelling, which was small. We found also large pieces of hewn worm-eaten timber, and some three or four cannonballs.
Nearby, Champlain wrote,
I searched for a place suitable for a settlement. I could find none more convenient or better situated than the Point of Quebec, so called by the savages, which was covered with nut trees. I at once employed a portion of our workmen in cutting the trees down, that we might construct our habitation there. The first thing we made was the storehouse for keeping under cover our supplies.
Champlain's trading post was the nucleus of the future city of Quebec, named after an Indian word meaning where the river narrows. To begin with, it was run by the Company of New France, a trading company more interested in acquiring furs from the Indians than in colonisation. So in 1663, the French crown took over the company, shipping out settlers, soldiers, servants, and, to boost the birth rate, girls from a Paris orphanage known as the Daughters of the King. To succeed in North America, however, the French had to break out from their icy footholds along the St. Lawrence. This they did, thanks to the splendidly named René Robert Cavelier, Sieur de La Salle, a Jesuit priest who'd resigned from the order on grounds of moral weakness and then tried his luck in Canada. In 1682, La Salle mounted an expedition across the Great Lakes and down the Mississippi River, hoping it would carry him to the Pacific and open up the route to China. It didn't, of course, but he changed the map of America. With 23 Frenchmen and 31 Indians, La Salle crossed Lake Michigan and made his way to a river called by the Indians Chicago. The water was frozen and they had to drag their canoes and supplies. But once on the ice-free Mississippi, they made rapid progress. Food and supplies were readily obtained from local tribes, most of whom were very friendly. One French priest described a typical encounter.
All those of the village, except the women who had at first taken flight, came to the bank of the river to receive us. Here they built us cabins, brought us wood to burn, and provisions in abundance. For 3 days they feasted us constantly. These Indians do not resemble those at the north, who are all sad and severe in their temper. These are far better made, honest, liberal, and happy.
It all seemed very promising. La Salle's party pushed south past the abandoned Indian mounds of Cahokia and built a fort where the city of Memphis, Tennessee, now stands. Eventually, after travelling for 8 weeks, they reached the ocean. On a bare hillock overlooking the Gulf of Mexico, La Salle erected a cross and a column mounted with the arms of France. His men sang the Te Deum, fired a salvo of muskets, and chanted, Vive le roi! Then La Salle declaimed,
In the name of the Most High, mighty, invincible, and victorious Prince, Louis the Great, by the grace of God, King of France and of Navarre, 14th of that name, this 9th day of April, 1682, I, in virtue of the commission of His Majesty which I hold in my hand, do now take possession of this country.
He named it Louisiana, in honour of the Sun King, Louis XIV. La Salle had staked out a claim along the Mississippi, America's great north-south waterway. If the French could make good on it, they would control the heart of that continent. But Louisiana was the same story as Quebec a century before. The French failed to consolidate their early gains. In 1684, La Salle mounted a new expedition from France to establish a firm presence along the lower Mississippi, but it all went disastrously wrong. Only one of his four ships made it across the Atlantic, and this landed too far west on what is now the coast of Texas. La Salle spent 3 fruitless years hunting for the mouth of the Mississippi, until he was gunned down by his mutinous followers. According to Henri Joutel, his trusted aide, the assassins
barbarously stripped the wretched dead corpse and vented their malice in vile and opprobrious language. In conclusion, they dragged it naked along the bushes and left it exposed to the ravenous wild beasts.
Joutel paid his leader a justly balanced tribute.
Monsieur de La Salle had a capacity and talent to make his enterprise successful. His constancy and courage and his extraordinary knowledge of the arts and sciences, together with an indefatigable body, would have procured a glorious issue to all his undertakings, had not all those excellent qualities been counterbalanced by too haughty a behaviour, and by a rigidness towards those that were under his command, which at last drew on him implacable hatred and was the occasion of his death.
Around 1700, the French tried again, establishing forts on the Gulf coast at Biloxi and Mobile, but these were still only toeholds. In 1717, the French crown, bankrupted by years of war, had another go at privatisation and ceded Louisiana to another trading company, the Company of the Indies. This shipped to Louisiana several thousand French and German settlers, but they were soon decimated by disease and crop failure. One French officer recalled,
The famine was so bad that a greater number died, some from eating herbs they did not know, and which, instead of prolonging life, produced death. Others from eating oysters, which they went and gathered on the seashore.
In fact, about half the Europeans transported across the Atlantic to Louisiana didn't survive. In 1731, the ruined company was taken over by the French crown in yet another policy flip-flop. The colony had only 2,000 white settlers, but there were also 4,000 black slaves imported from Africa. Without slavery, struggling Louisiana wouldn't have survived. By the early 18th century, French territory stretched from the Gulf of St. Lawrence to the Gulf of Mexico, through the heartland of the American continent and down its greatest waterway, the Mississippi. French America therefore blocked off British expansion westward from New England and also separated Spain's dominions in Florida from those in Texas and New Mexico. Above all, the port of New Orleans, named for the Prince Regent, was strategically located to command the delta of the Mississippi. New Orleans took time to get going. In 1722, the French explorer Pierre de Charlevoix found only
100 barracks placed in no very good order, a large war house built of timber, and 2 or 3 houses which would be no ornament to a village in France.
But Charlevoix had no doubts about the city's prospects.
Rome and Paris had not such considerable beginnings, and their founders met not with those advantages on the Seine and the Tiber which we have found on the Mississippi, in comparison of which these two rivers are no more than brooks.
Yet New France remained a fragile empire. It was a hierarchical society of landlords and tenants, which, unlike the freehold that was normal in New England, discouraged enterprise and expansion. Settlements were few and far between. LaSalle's dream of a series of towns right down the Mississippi was never realized. And because there were never enough women to make the population self-sustaining, growth depended on continued migration from across the Atlantic, particularly African slaves, but also the cast-offs from French prisons. Above all, the French colonies weren't economically viable. They cost the king more to defend and administer than they generated in trade. You couldn't really grow profitable crops like sugar and tobacco in icy Canada. You could try in Louisiana, but the climate there oscillated unpredictably between floods and drought. And transporting the produce of Canada or Louisiana to Europe took longer and cost more than exports from the Atlantic seaboard controlled by the English. As one Governor General of New France observed ruefully,
"We should never delude ourselves that our colonies on the continent could ever rival the neighbouring English colonies in wealth, nor could be very lucrative, for with the exception of the fur trade, the extent of which is limited and the profit continually declining, these colonies can furnish only goods similar to those of Europe, at high prices, and of poorer quality."
So France's American empire was built on shaky foundations, for which New Orleans serves as an apt metaphor. Much of it was actually below sea level, and in September 1718, just a few months after being founded, the town was demolished by a hurricane and floods. In due course, as Charlevoix predicted, New Orleans would enjoy a glittering prosperity, but fundamentally it rested on mud. The French did leave their mark on the future United States. They founded what became great cities such as Detroit and St. Louis, and the state of Louisiana's legal code is still based on French Roman law. But France's lasting influence was less profound than that of Spain. And in fact, neither of these European powers put down deep roots in North America. In 1700, New France had only 15,000 people. But even that was more than the colonies of Spanish North America. In contrast, the white population of the English colonies in 1700 numbered nearly 250,000. Neither Spain nor France had been able to capitalise on its head start in building a North American empire. As the 17th century wore on, the coming power was their hated Protestant enemy across the Channel. The English did empire much better, at least in North America. Their secret was a potent but volatile mixture of liberty and slavery that would define the future United States.